Thanks for the opportunity to give this talk here. So I want to talk about some joint work with Ragnar Buchweiz. Actually work that was begun during my first visit in Toronto, which was 16 years ago. The fact that we did not finish the work yet has to do with certain laziness and also some technical points. So I first want to talk about matrices and modules. Well, my story, I want to start with work by Hesse from 1842, where Hesse considered what is now considered called the Hesse pencil of elliptic curves in the plane, given by the zero set of this polynomial in three variables. And then one considers the Hessian, called after Hesse, which is the matrix made up of the second partial derivatives, so which in this case, of course, then is 6x, 6y, 6z, and then xy lambda xz lambda y lambda x. So it's a symmetric matrix, of course, and it's a matrix of linear forms in very simple polynomials of degree 1 in x, y, and z. And now we put f being at the determinant. So let's call this matrix A. The determinant of this matrix A, and I leave you the pleasure to compute it, and as we all know, it is again a cubic in Hessian normal form, but now you have some different parameter x, y, z, and there is some overall constant. So starting with the cubic curves, you could produce a new cubic curve, but now this cubic curve is written as a determinant of this matrix. So so we let B is the Cramer matrix of A. I'm not completely sure whether this is a known concept here in the Cramer matrix. So it's the matrix made up of the n minus 1 cross n minus 1 minors of the original matrix, and then put them in a reflect them on the diagonal and add a sign so that you get A times B, and B times A is F times the unit matrix. And in this case, of course, it's the 3 cross 3 unit matrix. But what we got here is, from this representation as a determinant, we get a matrix factorization. So we have factored the irreducible equation F as a product of two matrices, two commuting matrices, A and B, and in this case, matrix B is simply determined by A in, by taking the Cramer matrix. And now, I don't think this is historically the first example of a matrix factorization, but it's an early one. The teacher of Hesse was Jacobi, and as you know, Jacobi used matrix factorizations to describe the Jacobian of a hyperelliptic curve in his work on... but it's about the same time. And But now I got a suspicion after thinking about that probably Kramer, the Kramer's rule, this is Kramer's rule, that he may be written down the first matrix factorization. So, what's the interest in having this structure? This was first discussed by Hesse, and I develop a little notation. So if we take A, any n cross n matrix with entries polynomials, and we have mu one, mu n, mu two tuples of numbers. So I think of these as lying in the projective n minus 1 space, so they should not all vanish. Then what Hesse does is consider this matrix. It's the determinant of this matrix. Where we put the matrix A here, and then append a 0 at the lower corner, and then write here the mu's, and here the new as an extra row and an extra column. So you increase the size of the matrix by 1 and then take the determinant, and I use this symbol A mu nu for this new matrix. And if you look what happens if we do it in that case, we will get a matrix, we will get a polynomial of degree 2. So what Hesse shows is the following identity. Mod F, well, where F is the determinant of A. So for any matrix A and any two vectors mu and nu, we have this identity, modulo F, which is, if you think about it, is just a slight generalization of the fact that the Kramer matrix of a given matrix, the matrix consisting of maximal minors of a matrix, the Kramer matrix has rank 1 when we restrict to the locus where the determinant is 0. So the Kramer matrix of a matrix is a matrix of rank 1 modulo the determinant. This is an identity, nice identity. And why was Hesse interested in this identity? Because it has a clear geometrical meaning, which I will now write down. If A is symmetric, which it was in the example I gave, but it was general, then the curve defined by the equation touches the curve so if in the case where in the case where f is a polynomial of three variables, so in the example. So in the example we get that if this is the cubic curve given by the equation f is zero, then this curve d mu, depending on parameter mu, is a conic which will in general intersect the cubic curve in 6 points, but it does intersect only in 3 points and at each of these points twice. And by varying this parameter mu, you vary this conic, so that you see the advantage of writing the equation f as a determinant is that now I can immediately write down these tangent conics. And in fact, if you look at the equation which is here, if you look at this relation between lambda and lambda tilde, then you see, from if you compute it explicitly, that given lambda tilde, there are three lambdas for which, so given f, you can find three lambdas which give you the same lambda tilde. So the lambda tilde is a polynomial of degree 3 in lambda. So, let's compute it. So for each lambda, there exist three lambdas such that f belonging to the parameter lambda tilde is the determinant of the Hessian of g belonging to the parameter lambda. So that means that there are basically three different ways in which a conic can have contact with the cubic. So it can also look like this. So there are three possibilities. So we get three contact systems. So the theory of symmetric matrices is intimately related to the theory of contact systems. And you can do the same for curves of degree 4. Then you will find 35 different ways of writing a degree 4 curve as a symmetric determinant, linear determinant. And there are, so the 4, degree 4. 35 families, and in general they are related. In general, to the number of ineffective theta characteristics on the curve, G is the genus. This is a side remark, but this is showing where the classical interest in algebraic geometry was for writing equations as determinants, and specifically symmetric determinants. Also, Hesse looked at the problem, what about not writing curves, so forms in three variables as determinants, but forms with four variables, or more variables. So if you have a symmetric matrix in four with entries, polynomials in four variables, so the determinant will be a polynomial, homogeneous polynomial with four variables will be determine a surface in free space, and it will have nodes with singularities. That means that a smooth surface in P3 cannot be written as a symmetric determinant, and in fact it cannot be written as a determinant at all if we take the equation to be generic. So, these are classical aspects. Now let me come to the following. So I will consider a polynomial or a power series. So P will be, say, a regular local ring or graded ring. So think about a formal power series ring or the polynomial ring. And if you consider the polynomial ring in many variables, then you usually take it as a graded ring. So what I think, we'll think about this ring all the time. And also the field will later be the field of complex numbers. Then one forms this ring by dividing out this element F. So this is the hypersurface ring. And I will consider X will be just the spectrum of this object, or just the locus X, where this is zero. And in the case where we had it before, we had a curve in the plane, so here this X will be a conical singularity. Even if this curve in the plane is smooth, if it built the cone we find here, so this is my X. And if the space is polynomial is homogeneous, then I can look at this projective curve, but this is just a special case. In general, F will be non-homogeneous and you get some sort of deformed cone. Now, if we take well, matrix factorization, set of matrix factorizations of F is also is just a set of matrices A and B in the matrices with entries in this P, such that AB is BA is F times the identity matrix. And now this is just a set, and of course there are groups acting. You can change bases and you get a different matrix factorization, but they're essentially the same. You can make this into a nice category, even in you can construct out of it a very nice triangulated category, which was considered by Buchweitz around that time. I will today not talk about that, because the thing I'm talking about is using much less of the subtle structure in such triangulated category. So what I will do is, if I take such a pair of matrices, you can associate to it just a module. M is the co-kernel of the first matrix. This is an R module. So if you think of this geometrically, it will be some sort of by making it into a sheaf, we get a coherent sheaf on X, on this cone. But it will be a very special type of sheaf, coming from the fact that we have this structure of matrix factorization. And in fact, this module one gets here, so M is a MCM, maximal Kolmogorov module. So this means that the depth, so the maximal length of a regular sequence, is the same as the dimension, which is the dimension of this cone. So the depth of this module is the same as the number of regular elements is the dimension of that cone. So this is what you call maximal Kolmogorov module. And in the example I gave of Hesse, there one has following in the example where we have then the matrix was a 3x3 matrix, which I wrote down, and then the co-kernel of this matrix can be identified, small exercise, is the ideal ideal of the contact points. So I have this cubic curve at these three points. They make up an ideal in the polynomial ring. This ideal has three generators, and between these three generators there are three relations, and this gives you the matrix A. So here one sees the interaction between just the algebra of these matrices and the geometrical content of the cycle sitting on that curve. So anytime you have a matrix factorization, you get some interesting bundle on your variety, some interesting sheaf which cannot be explained by coming as a sheaf which does not come from the ambient space. These three points do not lie on a line. Therefore, this is not a complete intersection. Therefore, it is a non-trivial sheaf, and this will give a matrix factorization. So here we see the relation between cycles, the existence of special cycles, or any algebraic cycles on projective varieties, and the existence of maximal Kolmogorov modules on the corresponding cone. So, Eisenberg's theorem is of course very important, which says that basically these modules and these matrix factorizations are equivalent objects. So if M is non-free MCM on the ring R, then this corresponds in a precise sense. If you make it very precise, you become a statement about categories. But if you have any non-free maximal Kolmogorov module, this corresponds to a matrix factorization. AB of F, such that the module M is just the co-kernel of the matrix A. And the proof is very simple, therefore I give the proof. We take, does this work actually? No. We take this module, which is a module over R, so it's a sheaf which lives on this cone. But I can also consider this as a sheaf or a module over the polynomial ring, so I can resolve it over the polynomial ring. And because it's maximal Kolmogorov, it means that the depth as P module, which is the same as the depth as R module, is the same as the number of as the dimension of the cone. And therefore the projective resolution has length 1. So we find a matrix A, this sort, such a module necessarily has a resolution over P of one step. And now we multiply by F, on this module, multiplication by F. Well, M is a module over R, that means that multiplication by F is just a zero map. So you have a zero map here. Here we have multiplication by F on the polynomial ring to the power N, and here the same. So this is on the level of these complexes, very short complexes, and this expresses the fact. So now we want to express the fact that this map is a zero map, and it's exactly that there is a homotopy. So here we have A again, a matrix B. So there must exist a matrix B such that this occurs, and then you have A times B is F, and B times A is F. You find the matrix factorization. So it's very easy. So this is the resolution as a P module of the polynomial ring. But the resolution as R module is 2-periodic. So, if you go about with this diagram, divide out the F here, you get here the ring to the power N, and you play a little bit with exact sequence, you immediately find that you have this. So you have an infinite two-periodic complex, becomes two-periodic. So the dimension, projective dimension of the module as a module over this ring R is infinite, which of course is the general case because this ring R is not regular. Only if the ring is regular, you get a finite resolution. And this is exactly the modules which go on forever. But the strong statement is, if they go on forever, then they become two-periodic. There are modules which, over this ring R, which have a finite resolution. But these are the modules which you should consider as trivial. And if you construct that triangulated category, you throw away these modules which have finite projective dimension, so the perfect complexes, in order to concentrate on the modules which have this two-periodic resolution. So, this is in the 80s. Then the modern interest, I will say something. In these matrix factorizations, first of all, in singularity theory, there are quite some works written on the determination of all matrix factorizations of a given singularity, of a given F. So given F, what are possible matrix factorizations? For example, there are, of course, classical works and newer works from in singularity theory, detailed study of examples. Then I understand that there is an interest from physics, deep brains, nowadays. Deep brains, but this is of course obvious because this is in Landau-Ginzburg theory, which is the same as singularity theory. So this is no surprise. And a third thing which I heard about, which was very surprising to me, that it's also in knot theory. Hovanov-Rozansky work on link homology invariants, which I do not know anything about, but Ragnar showed me the paper, and if you want to know about this last, you should ask Dror, and if you want to know about this, you should ask Kentaro. And if you want to know about the first one, you can ask me. Yeah. So this is, yeah. This is where matrix factorizations came from in classical algebraic geometry and commutative algebra. Now I want to talk about the index theorem. Yeah. All modules which do not come from P2 are given by because if you take the hyperplane section, then you have a resolution over R which is finite. It's just given by the ring modulo some element. You can have this ring where L is modding out some linear form or any other curve. So any complete intersection of the curve with another curve is not seen. But if you take any non-complete intersection, which is not set of points on the curve, which is not obtained by intersecting with a second curve, and you start resolving it, you will find some matrix factorization. Of any number of points, yes. You can do this for any number. But of course, then so to describe this correctly, you have to work in this category where you model out all elements which have finite projective dimension. I didn't want to go in that. There are some papers now on this by some Russian guy, Orlov. But so this is the construction by Ragnar. Okay. Index theorem. So, the most famous index theorem is, of course, the Riemann-Roch theorem. So, if you have a X, say, a compact manifold, then compact, proper, then you can have this dimension HI XF when F is any sheaf on X, say vector bundle, then you take the churn character of the of F and multiply it by the thought class of X, and then take the component of the right, evaluate on the fundamental class, and this is a number, and this is an index theorem, because we have analytic information, dimensions of cohomology groups, and on the other hand we have topological information, the churn character, combination of the churn classes of F, the top class as well. So this is here, or you can say this is an intersection product, expressing the index as intersection product on X. And so you can do the same, of course, with X, EF, because this is the same as, well, H, I, X, E, dual, F. So you can do the same with E and F. You could do the same with Tor. The formula doesn't really change. I claim the most natural way to consider these theorems is with Tor. As being this can be seen by Serre's Tor formula, which is also an index theorem. So this is now a formula which can be considered to hold in a local situation. So we have X, say, is local. And we have two subsets, A and B. And we assume that they intersect in some finite scheme, some finite set of points in the intersection. But they might be, of course, very tangent or very strange intersection here. Now, we have the problem of defining the intersection multiplicity, which was solved by Tor by saying we do this. So this is not much of an index theorem in that sense that Serre used it as a definition of the intersection product. But, of course, in order this to make sense, well, or the length, the dimension of Tor. So these Tor groups are finite dimensional, and you take this Euler characteristic, and then you call it the intersection number. This is Serre's method. But then, of course, you have to show that it has all the properties you expect from an intersection number. But that's not so difficult. It's constant in the deformation. etc. But this is a index theorem. So how is calculated the tor? We take a free resolution of Ox as a of OA OA as a Ox module. And now because X is smooth, this process stops finite projective dimension. So we get a resolution, finite resolution. And to compute tor, we just take, replace this object O by this complex and then tensor it with OB. So we get OB. And then it's the homology of this complex. So this is, gives this alternating. So the cohomologies here are the tor groups. And by assumption that the cycles are intersecting in a finite set, these homology groups are finite, and therefore you can build this number and you show that it is invariant in the perturbations. Oh, the tor is the homology at spot I of this complex. This is the definition of the tor I. So where that complex, I cannot reach there. So let's call this C. For the moment, it's some complex. And take the homology in spot I. It was exact. You tensor it with OB. It's no longer exact. You take the homology at spot I. This is the definition of tor I. Doesn't depend on the choice of the resolution. So this is the definition of tor. And you take the alternating sum, some index. That's the intersection number. It's a very beautiful idea of SEAD. This is the beginning of the great use of commutative algebra in geometry. Local. In algebra locale multiplicité in this book. Now I want to come to back to the matrix factorizations and maximal Kolmogorov modules. So, we are again at the situation where we have R is the hypersurface ring, polynomial ring modulo some polynomial F. Now we take M, such a maximal Kolmogorov module over the ring R. So it has two periodic resolution. That means that, well, I wrote it down before, that you can use these two matrices to form a complex where you alternate A and B. Now, of course, the A times B is F, but in the ring R, you divide out F. So matrix factorization in physics usually is seen as you have A times B is zero. This is a differential for something. Product of two things being zero is perturbed to product of something is F. But if you divide out and go modulo this F, then of course you get an ordinary complex back. But you get this two periodic complex. So you have these two matrices. So you have this is a free resolution of M. So you have three R modules, you have these matrices, and this is, so to say, given the matrix factorization of some module, M is giving a free resolution of the module. Right? These matrices A and B alternate. Now, if we have another module, need not be maximal core Macaulay or any other R module, you can tensor this complex with the second module N. And then induced map A, or maybe A tensor 1, but I don't write that. B, and here again A, etc. So I take the module M, and now I take this complex and tensor it with N. Because this is two, so what is, now we get a complex. And the ith cohomology of this complex is, as before, this is the definition of the tor I over the ring R Mn. You can also use, of course, the functor hom to N, then you're computing ext. But this is basically the same. You can go from ext to tor by going from M to its dual. But I work with that tor here. So we get from this exact, this resolution, by tensoring with anything, we get a complex, no longer exact, and it will get homology groups, and these have a name, they're called tor. There they are. Now, because we have a two periodicity, there are basically only two tors. Or if you do hom, only two exts. So what you see from the two periodicity of the complex is that tor 1, I don't write arguments, is the same as tor 3. So the tor, every homological algebra they're all the same, because the complex repeats after two steps. Tor 0 is, of course, something different, because we cut off the complex here. But we could produce prolong in the other direction, then it would be valid for all integers. But sort of the 0 term is atypical, we don't consider that. So what we basically see, that the two periodicity gives two periodicity. Two interesting groups. Say tor 1 and tor 2. Tor. I call this tor odd and tor even. Okay. You get two interesting groups. Let me give some simple example where to see how to compute these things. Well, I take a very trivial example. We take the P, just the power series in two variables, and the F, product of the two variables. Now, F itself is reducible, so it's very easy to factor F in matrices. We can even factor F in polynomials, so we get a very trivial matrix factorization by doing this. Okay? So what is M really? M is really the ring modulo X. But if I divide out X, this is basically the polynomial ring in power series ring, one variable Y. Okay? You throw away the X. But now if I want to compute the tor, I take this module, resolve it, and now tensor it with the module itself. So rather than R, I write M. But M is R modulo X. So X is set equal to 0. So we get 0 here. So this is the complex C I had there. Now I have to take the homology groups. So this is CY. I know what it is, the power series in one variable. So here the homology here will be kernel of this map modulo the image. So it will be one dimensional at this spot. It will be infinite dimensional at this spot, at the zeroth spot. This is an exceptional spot. But here it will be this map is injective, so here we get 0, C, etc. So the tor, you see tor 1, tor odd is C and tor even is 0. So this is, in any example, easy to calculate. And in fact, computer algebra programs as Macaulay and Singular can compute very complicated groups of this type in a millisecond. So this is not difficult to compute on examples. But if you start doing a non-trivial example, no one will follow it. So now we define this term was coined by Ragnar, the Herbrand difference is defined to be theta mn equals, well, what do we take? The dimension, a C vector space of tor even tor odd. So of course these tors might be non finite dimensional, but this finite dimensional if f, the function f, defines an isolated singularity. Or, if F is homogeneous, it defines a smooth projective hypersurface. And so it just means that the locus where all the partial derivatives F, that this consists only of the origin. Because these modules, the only spot where the space X has infinite projective dimension is this only point. So this is the only point where we get, we will get contributions for a Tor even and Tor odd. So this is defined for arbitrary modules over an isolated singularity. M and N can be arbitrary. So the question is, what is the corresponding index theorem? Obviously, this is an index in the same sense as the Riemann-Roch theorem or the Tor formula of Serre. So what is it? So what is the meaning? Theta Mn. Now, the first thing you might think of, well, it's like a sort of an intersection number. Now, on a singular space, there is no sensible intersection theory. It doesn't exist. And even if it did exist, it would give the wrong answer. This can be seen from the example I gave before. This number can be negative. So it's certainly sort of more subtle. Local intersection number is positive or zero. So intersection theory on X. X, so this is this cone, does not exist. You can take the book of Fulton on intersection theory, which is doing intersection theory in the most general sense. But you will see, if you're going to intersect objects, then always one of the objects will be locally complete intersection. It would mean that locally the module, the Kolmogorov, the matrix factorization part of it is zero. So it does only exist in a way that one of the two cycles is of finite projective dimension, and then you can use Tor formula of Serre. So it does not exist, even would give wrong answer. It's not an intersection number in the usual sense of the word. And what I want to explain to you is that the following theorem is true, that you can interpret this number as a linking number. Of the two characteristic classes associated to the modules M and the modules N. So the Chern character, of course, occurs also in the Riemann-Roch theorem, so we get it here. In the Serre formula, you have an intersection product, but in this situation, you have to replace it by a linking number, which I have to define precisely what it means, how this linking is supposed to work. This is sort of non-obvious, but it gives a topological interpretation for this number as a linking number. Yes, but it is the Chern character from ordinary K-theory to homology theory. So I have to say where this lands, and have to make precise. Yeah. But this is basically the formula. And I have to explain how it works. So there is a special case. Which is much easier to handle. Namely that F is homogeneous. And in the polynomial ring with 1 to 2m plus two variables, an even number of variables, so, and now we can let y be the proj, so the projective hypersurface defined by f, this lives now in the projective space one variable less, so this is y is dimension 2m, and now we take two cycles a and b on y, and let them have ideals in this polynomial ring. So these are the homogeneous ideals of these cycles. Then one can show that formula, which involved this linking number, now can interpret it as a intersection number, namely that the difference of p of the, say, the ring, so this is also in the cone, the ring of the cone. This is, now I have to look, looks more complicated. Where d is the degree of f, and h is the hyperplane class. Hyperplane. So this is a cycle. You can see it's a cycle on y, and then you perturb the cycles a and b a little bit, and then take the intersection product on y. Intersection. And it only works if A and B intersect in a finite number of points on Y. So I'll put this. So the geometric number of intersection points is finite. Then that number has this meaning. So in the case of a homogeneous polynomial, you have the spectrum. This is this cone and the associated projective variety. We do intersection theory on this projective variety. In the general case where the function f is not homogeneous, you don't have a projective variety where one could possibly work on, even if the function is quasi-homogeneous, so homogeneous with weights, then the associated projective hypersurface would have singularities, and you will have all sorts of problems there. So you cannot, you cannot construct in general such a space Y if you have any non-homogeneous polynomial. This part of the problem. Yeah, middle dimension. Yeah, in this formula. Yeah, dimension is n. Yeah. So now I want to tell you how one can get in this direction of this theorem, and that is third part of the lecture will be K-theory. As you probably know, the natural way to understand index theorems is in K-theory. It was developed by Grothendieck and Attia, and Later, we have algebraic K-theory by Quillen. This is what we will need. And the first step in proving the theorem, express in terms of K-theory. Okay, and there are many sorts of K-theory, so I have to tell you what it is. So, if you have any topological space X, then you may think of topological K-theory when we have K0 of X, which is the Grothendieck group of vector bundles on X. And this will account for the even dimensional part of the cohomology of X using the Chern character. So K0 of X via the Chern character, if it tends over Q, will be the even part over Q. This is for topological space. And if we want to see the odd part of the cohomology, we look at K of X, K1 of X. How to think of K1 of X? You can think of this as a vector bundle on the suspension of X. You have the space X and you take the double cone. And then you get K1 odd. Higher Chern class for K1. You also know how to write down the Chern character if X is, say, a smooth manifold and we have a vector bundle. We can use a connection and then write the Chern formula in terms of the curvature of this connection, and then you get a specific differential form on the manifold that represents this class. So this is a standard thing. And another way to think about, so K1 is a little bit more exotic because we work with vector bundles on suspension. This is X, this is suspension of X, double cone. But each of these halves of this cone, of the suspension, are cones. They're contractible to a point. So the same, you can say, K1 of X is given by taking a vector bundle on X and an automorphism with automorphism. So some diagram of the type alpha E to E, where alpha is this gluing map from the upper to the lower half. This is another way of thinking about K1 using automorphisms. And if you have an automorphism, then what can you do with it? You can take the determinant. That's usually what people do in mathematics. And for automorphism, we have the determinant. And we have seen already that in the beginning, I was using determinants. So there you have the sign that, so K1 is the theory of the determinant. And then one should try, there will be some K1 coming in the game. So this is topological K-theory. So if K0 and K1, and together they account for all the cohomology. But now you have algebraic K-theory. Which is much more difficult to handle. So if you have any ring R, then you can define k i's of R, higher algebraic k groups. So in this case you can also define k2, but it's isomorphic to k0. K theory is two periodic also. That's also why k theory is naturally attached to these two periodic complexes. For a ring, we have a higher algebraic K-theory, Quillen. And later he generalized this to, with any abelian or exact category, abelian category, you can define K-groups of this category, higher algebraic K-groups for the category. And this is very flexible because there are many categories around always, and if you take A is the module category of a ring R, then is the algebraic K theory of the ring. Any ring can be even non-commutative. But you know, the K groups of the integers are not known. I think K4 of the integers, I think, well, is zero. But K5 is probably not known for the integers. So, how are these K groups of a category defined? This is, of course, the core of Quillen's work. So the trick is that one has to yeah, I cannot go in the details, of course, because it would take a long time. That one, these K groups are defined as homotopy groups of some group of some space attached to the category. These K groups are of the form homotopy groups of some auxiliary space, and I will take this few versions of the construction. GA, space constructed by Gillet Grayson, which is for many purposes the easiest to work with. And just to give an idea, it's a space attached to a simplicial complex, and you have to say what the simplices are of this space. It's given as a simplicial complex. What are the simplices? K simplex looks as follows. This is N, K. And now one usually writes some is in between. So this is a change of, so think of it as injective maps, inclusions. Two sequences of these, this is called a K-simplex. There's one condition, namely with the same quotients. If you have this, you can form P0, P1 modulo P0. You can form Q1 modulo Q0. You require these quotients to be the same. So let's say a zero simplex, so point in this space, consists of two objects, and in the traditional way of thinking, it would be the class of the difference of the two vector bundles you were looking at, like in the Grothendieck group. In the one simplex, will be things of this sort, such that P1 modulo P0 is the same as Q1 modulo Q0. So there are, these are some one simplex. And then there is the notion of two simplex, etc. And this gives you a definition of a topological space attached to the category, and you take the homotopy groups of that. And then, this is the K groups. So, already the definition is involved in the way of computing in these spaces, and it's rather involved. But there is a a representation of elements in K1. As double exact sequences, double short exact sequences, double short exact sequences. So, you know the notion of exact sequence, of course, the defining structural property of a exact category, and the double exact sequence is just two exact sequences with the same members. So this is a double exact sequence, and this gives an element in K1. So out of this diagram one can construct simplices, and these simplices give a loop in this space. This is a little bit involved, so out of each, is not obvious, out of such a loop in the element in K1. This is of course much easier to work with. A double exact sequence, you can may come you might happen to you that you have a double exact sequence. But you never work with these simplices. This is very cumbersome. The double exact sequence is a very fine notion. And now it appears that if you have a maximal Kolmogorov module or a matrix factorization, then it is naturally attached to it a double exact sequence. And you can therefore get an element in the K1. Definition. Let F be an element in P, as before, and we have a matrix factorization, and we have X is the locus where F is zero, so the spec of R, as before. And now I put U as an isolated singularity. U I define as the complementary, I remove the singularity from the space, so this is the cone, if you think about it, the cone, this is X, here we remove this thing, so you get an open scheme, open manifold. So this is now manifold, smooth. Now I define M is the co-kernel A. So this is the module, the maximal Kolmogorov module that belongs to this matrix factorization. Now I define the class of M, the co-kernel of A. So this is a module over X, or a sheaf on X, and then replace it, restricted to this open set U. So this will be now some vector bundle on U, and this gives an element in K0 of U. Oh, I will use notation Ki of some space X will be the Ki of the coherent sheaves of X. We take that category. So you can work with the category of coherent sheaves on U. There's a K theory. And I also define an element in K1 of U. And for this, I use a double exact sequence associated with matrix factorization. So the interesting aspect here is usually some object has one class, Turing class, but in this situation it has two different, one in K0 and one in K1. There are two classes, and both are important. So how is this class in K1 constructed? This is not obvious. So we have this two-periodic complex. So this two-periodic complex you can split into short exact sequences. And what you will get is something like the kernel of A sitting in R to the power N, and then the image of A. So this is short exact sequence. I just split the sequence, and I can do the same for B. And here we get the kernel of B, image of B. Now, because it's a complex, you will have that the kernel of A, it's exact complex, kernel of A is the image of B. And the image of B, now the kernel of B is the image of A. So this one gets identified with this one, and this one with this one. So you get a very strange loop, of these things. And if you look at it carefully, you can derive from this a double exact sequence, double short exact sequence. So it's almost here, it's a little bit flipped, but you can unflip this in some way. And then you derive from this two sequences, you get a double short exact sequence. And this gives an element in K1. It would cost some time to explain this in more detail. So let me come up with the upshot from this. So Huh? Oh. Okay, but we need to copy then. So here we have X, here we have the origin, and we have the complementary open set, which in mathematics is always included by the map J, and then the singular point is included with the map I, and you remove this origin. From this, this is a fundamental result in Quillen, that if you have such a situation, you are in the situation where you have a thick subcategory, a serre subcategory. You get a long exact sequence. Yeah. So in general, if you have any sort of exact sequence of categories, this is a serre subcategory or category. Or so this is closed under the extensions and subobjects, and well, Ragnar probably did the definition precise, but a thick subcategory. You can divide out and have a sort of a quotient category, and in that case you get a long exact sequence for the K group. So this is fantastic. This is for always if you have sort of such a construction. Now we take the coherent sheaves on X, then the coherent sheaves supported on the point. This is a thick subcategory, a serre subcategory. The quotient can be identified with coherent sheaves which live on the set U. So we get something like Ki, so call this point P, Ki X, Ki U, and then there is a connecting homomorphism Ki minus 1 P. So this is fantastic, this works always. This is Quillen's great theorem. You can do a lot with this. So in our situation, what we get is, in any case, we get a map delta from the K1 of U to K0 of the point. This is the map delta, the boundary map. And this can be described on the level of these simplices. It's combinatorially involved, this map, but the K theory of a point, this is vector bundles on a point, this is just Z by the function dimension. Take the dimension of the object, so this is an isomorphism. So I can attach to each element in K1 an integer, and you see U, the set U, is a open set. It's homotopy equivalent to a manifold of odd dimension. Therefore, I need the K1, because I need to get the odd cohomology. I have to do this. So we have this map. There are products in K-theory. And if you think about these as bundles, and here these double exact sequences, then it's just tensoring the elements in the double exact sequence with the bundle here. So this is induced by tensor product. So I write just tensor product. And now I can state the theorem which expresses this index in terms of K-theory on U. Is the dimension, this dimension map, then the boundary map, then I take the K0 class of the first module and tensor it with the K1 class of the other module. So this is now expression in K-theory. At this moment you know that you have won, because now you're on a smooth space. Here we have this length of these Artinian modules which sits on the singularities. You have modules of infinite projective dimensions, you don't know really how to work with that. But now this formula shows that this index has an expression in terms on the smooth part of the manifold, which involves this class in K1, tensoring with the class in K0, and then using this boundary map to get an integer out of it, to bring you from some mysterious unknown group K1 to some very concrete group Z, the integers. So this is a formula, a very nice formula, and you can go from, this is higher algebraic K-theory, but you can go to topological K-theory. There is just a map from, if you have the mapping from coherent sheaves on U, this is, because U is smooth, you can do it with projective modules on U, and this is the same, you can define a map to just topological vector bundles on U. And this is a homotopy equivalence, or in any case gives a map, same formula. In the topological, where I replace everything in the definition by using the categories of topological vector bundles. And therefore, the number you define in this way is a topological invariant. This is just a commutative diagram. So because it was defined on this finer level, it is true in the, it's just a commutative diagram. This still does not bring us to complete topological understanding, but at least at this point you have captured the index topologically. And now we can just analyze what will happen if we go to the cohomology by the Chern character, and what happens to this formula. And this will then bring us to the formula I gave in the beginning, but maybe I need a break, or we should stop to give people the opportunity to leave the lecture without disturbing or embarrassing the speaker. So let's make a short break, and then I will give some hint how to go with the topological. So this involves the topology of isolated singularities, the Milner fiber, the knot, the link of the Milner fiber, and some basic topology of isolated singularities. Okay.
The symmetry.
Yeah.
Is there a formula which
says
that this is
symmetric? Yeah, it's symmetric. Symmetric? Yeah, this is symmetric. But you can define an non-symmetric if you use the X.
Why is
it
symmetric?
Because this Euler character is not symmetric. Yeah. Yeah, but you take the X. And for the X, it is not symmetric.
Yeah.
But I take the tor.
Tor is usually,
oh,
the tensor.
Yeah, tensor is symmetric. Oh. But it is, you can do it with X in the same way.
So that means each M can have both non-zero this bracket and this bracket. Well, so the Maxwell formula K theory says that these are equal or something like that.
Yeah, but what it basically says that if you compute tor, you can resolve N and tensor with M, or you can resolve M and tensor with N. This is the same. This is the balancedness of the tor. This is also a non-trivial statement in homological algebra. You can one or the other way. But it's true. If you you can, yeah, it is not obvious from this description. But you started from something with the symmetric, so therefore.
So can you, are you going to tell us, how does this look, for example, in the case of these, AD singularities or something like that? When you have number of.
This has all been worked out. Yeah, but I cannot. You get the Coxeter diagram or the Dinkin diagram.
I see. So there is
But you have to do it right, and you have to do it in the right number of variables. For the matrix factorizations is periodic in adding two squares, I think, or maybe even four squares, not by adding one square.
Right.
And then you have to do it in the right dimension, because so. So I gotta stop. Not odd. Now I will tell after the break, because this has to do with the fact that the manifold U is homotopy equivalent to a smooth manifold of odd dimension. It's a link of the singularity. And therefore, there is, if you want to get some pairing, non-finishing, you have to go over the K1. That's what's.
So, I mean, is it just the filter kind of filter deflection number?